Sitting high atop the Cumberland Plateau in eastern Tennessee, looking out at this beautiful landscape of rolling hills, sits quietly St. Mary's Convent. It's an Episcopal Benedictine monastery, a place of retreat and ministry. It was started as an extension of a sister convent in Memphis, Tennessee, that was focused and dedicated on caring for the sick. It is said that the last surviving member of that monastery in Memphis, following the yellow fever epidemic of 1878, made her way to eastern Tennessee to begin St. Mary's. And Becca Stevens, who's an Episcopal priest on the campus of Vanderbilt University, likes to go there every year to write. There's an air of sacred around you. It's a place of peaceful reflection. And in recent years, the convent had to sell some of its majestic property under financial duress. It was purchased by a wealthy English philanthropist who built a four-story, state-of-the-art library high up there on the hill for everyone to see for miles on end. And high above the front doors, all the way across this gigantic building, was his last name as the founder of this library. Well, being a writer, Stevens was quite curious to see this enormous, brand new, state-of-the-art library. Four floors of nothing of books, names from the past, given to us from generations before, shaping our education and our culture. She wanted to peruse these shelves. So on her next visit to St. Mary's, she asked one of the residents how to find her way over to that adjacent property where she could spend hours, as she imagined, looking at these books. Well, to her surprise, the resident at St. Mary's gave her good directions. It was just a 20-minute walk. But she said, even though the library had been built over a year ago, there were still no books in it. None of those names from the past, just the name over the front door. Well, this made her even more curious. So she walked over there that afternoon, and about 200 yards away, she could see right there in the front of the library, overlooking the hills that could be seen for miles, was this tall bronze statue created in honor of the founder. And standing in front of the statue was this majestic reflection pool. So as she got closer, she could notice that the statue of the founder, whose name was over the front door, was holding in front of it a book. Quite fitting. Well, she got close enough to read the title of the book, which said, The Humble Approach. That humility is quite elusive. And even though the prophet Jeremiah never mentions this word, it is behind everything that we read this morning. As Jeremiah is trying to warn the people, why are you building cisterns for yourself? Cisterns that are cracked and will not hold water. He's trying to explain how the people have lost sight of God's presence in their lives or in the lives of their ancestors. And cisterns, which is hard for us to imagine, were the innovation of the day. They were the water supply. That it's how the people survived living out there in desert areas. They needed water for life, to grow their crops, to sustain their livestock, to create any sort of livelihood. And that's difficult for us to imagine. Perhaps We could envision living without running water. Every night, stumbling out the back door with nothing but a plastic flashlight, fueled by a couple D batteries, making our way to the outhouse in the heat or in the cold. Or perhaps rationing water from the well each and every day. Or looking around and deciding whose turn is it to bathe this week. But then imagine going into the kitchen and turning on the faucet, and there's running water. It is life-changing. This was the innovation of cisterns. They would dig these large, bell-shaped chambers down in solid bedrock that would catch the rainfall that only fell for a short period of months every year, so the cistern had to hold that water for the remainder of the year. Under no circumstances could they leak. And Jeremiah is saying, why build cisterns for yourself? Cisterns that will not hold water. Well, many of these cisterns were generations old, dug by people in years past. And the thought of abandoning a watertight water supply did not make sense. That Jeremiah is calling the people to rely on what others have done, to rely on what God has done even in the past, even in the journey of faith. That pride is pretending that we do not need the help of others. And humility is what Barbara Brown Taylor describes when she says, I lost track of my small self in the larger scheme of things. That humility doesn't reduce life, it makes it larger, where we then feel our smaller role and our connection to everything else. But this is not an easy process. It requires us to let go of a few things. In fact, Mary Ann McKibben Dana recommends taking your fist and squeezing it as tight as you can and as long as you can till your knuckles start to look white. And when you do, you feel your muscles throughout your entire body become rigid. You start to grit your teeth and your jaw becomes tight. It is absolutely exhausting. You can only do that for a brief moment before you have to start opening your hands and you feel all of your muscles relax. You feel it deep down in your soul as if you are reaching out to join hands with others or with God. And what Jeremiah says bluntly, Jesus says with a little bit more finesse, sitting there eating at the table of the Pharisees' house, when he tells them this story about a wedding banquet where we walk out to the mailbox and we open it up and we pull out this invitation and we realize it's to some special event and we cannot wait to open it. We're standing there in the middle of the driveway, tearing it open, trying to see who it is from, looking forward to celebrating with friends or family. And as soon as we read it, we look forward to being there, to getting dressed up, to seeing others, to be seen by others. And during this time at a wedding banquet, people would sit at this large U-shaped table where the guest of honor, the couple getting married, sits right there in the middle. And the closer you sat to the middle, the more important you were. You'd probably be called on to have a toast. You were someone prominent in their lives. But Jesus' advice is to sit as far from the middle as possible. Like walking into a restaurant and telling the hostess, you know, we really want that table back in the corner that's all squeezed together, full of traffic walking by right next to the door to the bathroom. That's not our first choice. But Jesus says those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. Humility comes or is related to that word humus, meaning to come from the ground. That we have that image of God leaning down, getting on one knee, reaching out with open hands, gathering the dirt, forming it, and then breathing life into it. That all of us, every single one of us, comes from the same ground and the same breath. And to see the image of God in us and in others, we have to approach this world with open hands. That a clenched fist might make us feel safe, but only for a moment. Because it is absolutely exhausting that Jesus approaches this world with open hands. He had open hands when he went to the Pharisee's house that day to eat, which might surprise us because time and time again, he is confronted by several different Pharisees that make his life more difficult. And he has open hands when he starts to call the disciples, who are as different from fishermen who spent their days in the hot sun throwing the nets over the boats, or a zealot who had far more passion than he did discernment, wanting to overtake Rome with nothing but force, or even a tax collector who nobody trusted because they were always cheating people out of money. That Jesus had open hands, caring for the sick, going to the forgotten, greeting the Samaritan woman at the well, offering her living water, or looking up and seeing the paralyzed man lowered down through the roof by his friends. That he had open hands to the poor, the widow, the child. He had open hands to his enemies as they mocked him on the cross. He had open hands to the entire world because he knew everyone comes from the same ground and the same breath. And it's why we have open hands when we come to this place. Whether it's reaching out to shake the hands of one another, or joining hands as we feed the hungry or comfort the grieving, or open hands to receive the bread and the cup. There are times in this life, though, when our only reaction is to make a fist, trying to hold on with everything that is in us because we are afraid, because we are hurting, because old wounds have not healed yet, or everyone around us seems to be clenching their fist as well, that we don't know what to say or what to do. So we clench our fists as tight as we can. In those moments, perhaps we could practice prayer by first clenching our fists as long as we can and as hard as we can until we cannot do that anymore. And then open our hands yet again to others and to God, remembering that we cannot do this alone, that we are not meant to do this alone, saying, God, please go with us and continue to hold on to us as we find our way in you. Amen.